Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome again to the Commentary Track, episode 4. I'm your host, handsome Frank Thompson, beloved idol of a million other women. We have a wonderful guest for you tonight, Marilyn Moss. Once again, I said tonight. Why do I do that? Never mind. Marilyn Moss is the author of two terrific biographies of film directors. One, George Stevens, the great director of Gunga Din, A Place in the Sun, the greatest story ever told, not the greatest movie ever made, but many, many other great films. Started out with Laurel and Hardy, worked with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, did everything that a film director needs to do, as far as I'm concerned. And her second book is on Raoul Walsh, another one of my favorite directors, usually known as an action director, but had quite a wide range and an interesting style. We'll talk about both of those very fascinating Hollywood personalities. There's something of a weird, magical story attached with this interview. I went to Marilyn's home in the Hollywood Hills to interview her. And I thought we had a fine interview, and we talked about interesting things and interesting people, and got along like two peas in a pod, duh. And everything was just groovy. I got home. I checked the little diskette from my Zoom R16 recorder, and there wasn't a thing on it. Not a word, not a sound. I checked and checked and checked, and it was completely gone. There was nothing there. So, with my tail between my legs, I sheepishly emailed Marilyn and told her that I had done something idiotic and I didn't even know what it was. But Marilyn was most forgiving. We made another appointment. A week or so later, I went back to her wonderful house in the Hollywood Hills, and we had a second interview, in which we went over much of the same material, but not quite, because these things are not that well planned out, and the conversation goes where it goes. Did this second interview, and then a few weeks later, I was loading stuff into my computer to start the editing process, because I did a whole pile of interviews before I even started putting everything together for the podcast. And out of nowhere, up pops the first Marilyn Moss interview. I have no idea how this happened. I have no idea. All I know is I have two good interviews with Marilyn Moss. So what I'm going to do, rather than go in and try to edit together some monstrosity, I'm just going to wait for a decent interval to pass and then play the other one someday soon. But I think it's interesting as it is, and it's different enough from the first one that if you've heard the first one, there'll be some new ground to cover. And if you didn't hear the first one, then you're not hearing this, so I'm not quite sure how that would work. So, without further ado, here's my talk with Marilyn Moss.
I had been interested in Stevens since I was very little. For my 12th birthday, no, a girlfriend's 12th birthday, the mother took us all to Westwood Village to see The Diary of Anne Frank. And I walked out of there, and I was just taken, and I thought, who made that movie? Who made that movie? So I've been interested in Stevens, you know, because his films were landmark moments in my childhood, especially Giant, you know, which I thought was bigger than life. And when I actually got to the papers on Giant, the archive at the Academy Library, I really had to take a moment. I was so moved and taken aback, you know, to see this thing that I had loved so much suddenly just being put together in pieces, you know, and at any rate, that gave me pause. But yeah, I've always been interested in Stevens. I didn't think a lot of people had interest in him, and I didn't realize how many directors adored him, how many working directors, not dead ones, adored him, because when I used to write reviews for the Hollywood Reporter, we had a meeting once at the Directors Guild because they were angry at us for not mentioning the names of the directors in our TV reviews because we didn't think the directors mattered all that much. And I remember sitting in the room at the meeting, and after we were done, about four directors walked over to me and said, So you're writing a book on Stevens. Can you tell me how did he do that fabulous close-up scene with the two of them, with, you know, Elizabeth and Montgomery kissing? And they said that that was so influential to me. And so I explained it, you know, how Stevens had a propensity for liking to run film backwards and forwards. And when you see, for example, I'm going to be jumping all over here, but when you see the scene in The Diary of Anne Frank with the cat, Mushi, on the counter,
yes,
and he's got his head in the collar, whatever that little thing is. Yeah, he learned that all from Laurel and Hardy. When he worked, he learned everything, I think, from Stan Laurel. I mean, a lot of things he had to know himself, but Stan Laurel, as I mentioned in the book, really taught him about the humanity in comedy. The softness in it, the humanity, the relationship between, as I say in the book, between the two culprits, and how they have a simpatico with each other, and how they eventually feel bad for what they've done. You know? But the other thing that Stevens always took from Laurel and Hardy was the gags. And, of course, the famous gag, of course, being the dinner scene in Alice Adams, where the father's shirt pops open, I don't recall the name of those things that they would wear, just the piece that would sit under the jacket.
Yeah, it's almost like a dickie. Yeah.
Yes, exactly, and it would pop open, and also he's eating a Brussels sprout, which he's never eaten before, and the thing drops on the table in close-up, and Hattie McDaniel tries to sweep it up, you know, on the table with the duster in the pan. Those are all gags from Stevens, and I think he continued to use them because he thought they were so heartfelt, heartwarming. He learned a lot of that from Laurel and Hardy. But he also was best friends at the time when he was working with them with Oliver Hardy, and Oliver Hardy introduced him to his wife.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. She worked, she was a little Maxenic girl, I believe, a little tiny thing. And this is in the documentary that George Jr. did. And they met one night at dinner, and she thought George Stevens was about 18, and he thought she was about 12, and it turns out, as she likes to say, we weren't. So, anyhow. But, yeah, Stevens, when I saw The Diary of Anne Frank, that was the moment for me, because when I want to do a biography. It begins when I love a film. That obviously, why would you want to know about someone's life if you didn't love their work?
Same way. It's interesting to me that we both got into our respective first books at the age of 12, because mine was exactly the same thing with Beau Geste. Yeah.
Yes, I know that.
I
know that. The Gary Cooper one.
The Wellman one, yeah.
Wellman.
Started me on a downhill path that is hasn't quite hit bottom yet, but is nearly there.
Well, I mean, people who publish the way we do usually teach, and so they don't need the money, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to teach anymore. I just hated it. 30 years was enough. So, Stevens, Giant, Diary of Anne Frank. Shane, I didn't know much about the Westerns, because when I was a kid, I was always watching melodramas. Betty Davis, Barbara Stanwyck, you know, they were family, right? I mean, these people were family. There was a TV, wasn't a series, but it was a Saturday night movie every Saturday night in L.A. at 11 p.m. called The Fabulous 52. And they would play old films, and that was the only venue. That was the only way you could see old films. Nobody, you know, of course, ran them anywhere. The Lemleys didn't start doing any of their stuff until the very late 60s, for me anyway. That was how we saw classic films and foreign films, because the Lemleys would run these things at midnight in their Regent Theater in Westwood. And my very first job was, ironically, to work at the Village and the Bruin. And I was an undergraduate, and which is where Anne Frank was playing. But we'd run over to the Lemleys and see all these foreign films and old films. But so The Fabulous 52 was the only way I would see old films, and I saw mostly melodramas. So I didn't know about Shane until I actually got to writing the book. than I really, of course, fell in love with it because of the inherent loneliness in it, which Stevens really understood. And I don't think a lot of people talk about. But a lot of the papers I saw in the collection, in the Stevens collection, the largest collection in the Academy Library, the largest collection of a single person, was that being a cowboy was a very lonely life, and that the image of that or the motif for that would be a cowboy, one or two sitting around a fire and singing a sad song, and that was for Stevens the Western. And he was in, of course, a very sad mood when he returned from the war, and A Place in the Sun was the first evidence of that. That's a film of tragic dimensions, even though he consciously tried to make it into a love story. It really became much more than he planned on. It became his war film. He came back from the war after his unit being the first photographic unit, the first Americans, although many people claim they were the first Americans into Dachau, but Stevens and his unit were there just at the liberation. And what he saw there, the rubble, the piles of dead bodies and things, and you can see that in the documentary that his son made, it changed him. It's not that he didn't try to get a comedy made after the war. He did, but Paramount wouldn't go for it. I think he was angling, since he got back from the war, to do A Place in the Sun, because he had been in love with that book even before he hit his 30s. I mean, he read it as a very young man, 22 years old maybe, and he always loved that book, and he wanted to make that film when he got back from the war. Of course, it took him a year to actually start working again. He was really depressed, and as Capra, his friend in Liberty Film, said, of all the people who came back from the war, George said the least amount to anyone about anything. He just kind of kept quiet, because that's the kind of guy he was anyway. So A Place in the Sun is, of course, a tragedy. And I think that his vision was tragic after the war. And Shane is certainly has very sad, melancholy undertones, if not outright visible.
Yeah, there are almost no laughs in any Stevens film after the war.
I know.
They're very rare. He becomes nothing. A very somber, very deliberate filmmaker.
And deliberate.
And I have a love-hate thing with Shane, because it's so beautiful. It's so perfectly constructed. But it's also the formality of it works against the Westernness of it somehow.
I think there have been criticisms of it for the way that, for the way that when Shane rides in to the frame and his head is kind of cupped by the antlers.
Yeah, you know, it's an astonishing shot.
Yeah, I know.
But you can't help but, when it happens, you think, how in the world did that...
Well, you know what? A lot that happened on that set happened by chance. The weather happened.
That had to have happened by chance. There's no way in the world, no.
He thought it wasn't going to work. He thought it was going to be a failure that day, and suddenly the weather changed, and he saw, oh, I think I can get success out of this. And, the scene where Jack Palance guns down Elijah Cook, Jr., yeah. That was happenstance, and I think a lot of that probably happened up in Lone Pine, too, for Gunga Din, but I'm more a fan of the, I like Gunga Din, but it's really a guy's film, you know.
It is. I love it, sure.
I think every man does.
How could you not?
He's young. Yeah, that, and I learned from doing the Walsh book, Horatio Hornblower. Every young boy loves Horatio Hornblower. So,
the adventure stuff. Sure.
Yeah.
But with Gunga Din, the interesting thing about that, and the one thing that always kind of nags at me about that film, is that he plays the comedy so broadly that sometimes I think it's to the detriment of the film.
I agree.
The undercranking, and Cary Grant. I love Cary Grant as much as any actor who ever lived. But man, is he playing it big in that film.
Having the time of his life.
Yeah, they're really being broad and overplaying
all the time.
One of the more famous photos that people always see, and it's in my book, is Stevens with the bullhorn or whatever you call that, directing. And there's so much exuberance on his face. He's like a young kid, and you kind of get the sense that that's how the set was. You know, I think Joan Fontaine said that's how things were, as little as she was in it, but she was on the set, and there was a lot of kidding going on the whole time. And I think Stevens was 39 years old. He was a kid himself. For a guy who was never anything but serious.
Mm-hmm.
Although I hear told that he had a great sense of humor on the set of Woman of the Year. There was evidence of it, because not everyone saw evidence of it, where he would joke around and tell Spencer Tracy how to play the scenes. And he would make fun of himself and Tracy at the same time. And according to Katherine Hepburn, he was just, you know, uproarious. People would fall over. Oh, John, come do my doc. Anyway, I'm not giving
coincidences.
Up. Yeah, really. So, the famous, you know, the legend about Stevens is that he was merry, the more the merrier before the war and not so much after. And I think that really became his downfall eventually, because he became so serious that he became overblown. And I think that showed itself, of course, in the last film, big film he ever made, which was The Greatest Story Ever Told, or as I call it, the longest movie ever made. Sorry, George Jr. Edit that out.
Tell me about that film, simply because I've never done any research into it myself. And were all those cameos thrust upon him as a way to get?
No, they were not. They were his idea. Something happened. Maybe it was after Diary of Anne Frank. I mean, maybe it was because he was in talks with Fox for The Greatest Story Ever Told. Wait a minute. Yeah, with Fox, even while he was still doing The Diary of Anne Frank. And he and Ivan Moffat, his right hand, thorn on in his side, who I talked to many times. Just, you know, Ivan was an old screenwriter, and if you feed him, he'd sing like a canary. You know, we would go out to lunch, and what a character. And so they decided that they were not going to make a comic book version of the life of Jesus. Now, as a Jewish girl, I have a lot of trouble with understanding when to say Jesus and when to say Christ, and George Jr. had to educate me on that. I still can't get it right. But as far as the cameos go, that I think is, that mistake represents the mistakes that he was moving into, that, you know, that overtook him. And they were of his own doing. His vision got so huge that, you know, he even had to have David Lean come in and do scenes,
yeah.
Shoot scenes. And there, this is a really great example of it, and George Jr. doesn't like this, but I've had this corroborated by two actors who were there at the time. All the cast would be dressed, and they'd be waiting at the bottom of the hill. And George would go up on a chair and sit there all day for 2 days straight to think about what he was going to do and how he was going to do it. And this was the height of, some people would say, he had lost it. He had lost his mind, or he had gotten so grandiose that I think he just became so overwhelmed with the task. And there's a wonderful book called Hollywood Holy Land,
mm-hmm.
written by Ken Darby, who has nothing good to say about George in this book, about the city that George built to make this film. And it really was a city. And the thing got so big. And if you look at the documentary that his son did, you see a very old-looking George, probably at age 65 or something, not that old, looking like he had been through the wars and saying, you know, well, if I had it to do over again, I probably would have done it the same way. I don't know whether I could get anyone to finance me anymore. But so I think that that certainly the word is that that film killed Alfred Newman, because the music was so difficult to do, and George was so on top of him, having his say in everything. George was one of the few directors, maybe one of the only ones, who had absolute creative control from the get-go, from when he was a young man. He insisted on it. And I guess because Alice Adams did well at the box office, he was given more creative control than a lot of directors got at that age, at that early stage in 1935. But so he was a stickler for, you know, like many directors, I'm sure, being in charge of every aspect of this film. And that, of course, as everyone knows, or would be interested in knowing, George Stevens shot as much footage as he could, because to him, making a film happened in the editing room. It didn't happen before. It was what he could put together.
Yeah, he was very different in that respect, especially that early on, because I think most directors would tell you that now. But in those days, most directors prided themselves on cutting in the camera and getting everything. John Ford wouldn't set foot in the editing room and didn't care anything about it.
Right. Walsh did the same thing.
Yeah. Walsh, Wellman, they were all, these guys wanted it. And Wyler, I think, was more of the Stevens school of just keep going, keep doing take after take after take, and build it later in some
way. What they used to call him, something 100 take, 1,000 take Willie or something?
Yes.
I don't have that right, but yeah. I know that's what... I tried to write a biography of Wyler. I did, right after George. I figured that was the way to go. And I looked in his files at UCLA and at the Academy Library, and I could not find enough of the man to do it. I tried for like 6 months.
Mm.
And what I came out of that experience thinking was I really should write a book on Bette Davis. You know, the two of them. But, yes, Walsh always, a good segue here, Walsh always, unless you're not done with George. Now, Walsh always liked to edit in the camera because he had more trouble with censors than anyone I know. Because I don't know all the directors who you know who have also had that issue. But so he liked to think, correctly or not, that no matter what they edited out of his footage, it still would look like what he wanted.
Hmm.
And, of course, you know, he didn't have editing going on when he was at Warner Brothers. I mean, their editors took over. But he felt satisfied enough to know. He also just wanted to get to the racetracks at 5. Walsh was always on time and always under budget or on budget and always on time. He really didn't like being late. Now, George Stevens didn't have that problem. The famous quip I have at the beginning of my book is, wish I had the book sitting here. But the thing about George Stevens has been making a certain film for 3 days, and already the guys run in, the producers run in and say, George, oh my God, they're really upset in New York. We're already 3 weeks behind, you know, and the boys in New York are really, really concerned. And George would say, okay, thank you very much, and just wait for them to leave and then go back and do what he wanted to do. I believe that was Fred Zinnemann who said that about George Stevens. But Walsh was, ironically, because you hear so many stories about Walsh and the wild days of his and nights of his life, which I think are mostly stories, Walsh was very serious, as was Stevens, about being very businesslike on the set. He probably was even more businesslike than Stevens. And he, if he found that he was a few days behind, he would cut pages from the script, make up for it. You know, just, oh, that goes. You know, in fact, Kirk Douglas complained about that when they were making Along the Great Divide. Kirk Douglas did not like Walsh. He thought he was raunchy and lewd.
Mm-hmm.
And
what's not to like?
I don't know. But so Walsh, yeah, was always concerned about money, the studio's money, because he knew that sooner or later that month, he would have to go to Jack and ask for more money, because either his wife, Miriam, the first wife, Miriam Cooper, was either bleeding him dry, which she did for about 30 years, 20, 30 years, because he was always late in paying her. Either that, or he was losing money or buying horses, losing money on the horses. And he liked to bet a lot. And so very early on in their relationship, when he got to Warner Brothers in 1939, he started asking Jack for money. And what he would do was speak to Jack in Yiddish, and not very good Yiddish. I had to have a lot of it translated. But he would try to say to Jack, well, he did say to Jack, oh, the Jews and the Irish, we have the world on our shoulders. You know, we have all the troubles in the world. Can you loan me a couple of bucks or a couple of thousand of bucks? And Jack always did, because he knew Walsh would always come in on time for him. So, and they were more than many other people at Warner Brothers. They were good friends. They were as much as you could be, as much as you could be, in the 30 years they worked together.
I think a lot of those guys really highly prized professionalism. I think they all poo-pooed the idea of art, and they all liked being good and being professional and doing the job. And at least that's the way they presented themselves publicly. And I don't know, I've never quite got a handle on Walsh stylistically. And maybe that's because he didn't grasp a single style like some others did. I mean, you could say the same thing about Wellman, except because I'm so familiar with Wellman's work, I see Wellman in those films all the time. I'm never quite sure that I see Walsh in those films. And maybe it's just because I don't know the films well enough. Although, I think I've seen pretty much everything that exists. But if you were talking about Walsh as a stylist, what would you say?
I would say it's difficult to talk about Walsh as a stylist. Walsh was, as many people have said in interviews who knew him, the best setup man in Hollywood. He knew exactly where to put the camera, what lens. He knew how to make the most out of any scene. And I think, and this is to his, reputation, he was one of the most natural directors. And I think that's one of the reasons you don't see as highly stylized. I remember talking to Pierre Roussian, a real supporter of Walsh in the 1960s, and probably responsible for his resurgence in France, if anything. Not here, of course, in the 60s. But he and his buddies were poo-pooing, directors like Hitchcock or... Wells, because they were so highly stylized. They wanted to talk about the more natural directors and lift them up, in the public eye. And that would be Wellman, Walsh, Hawks. So, yes, I had a problem like that also when I started working with Walsh, because he was so disparate, it seemed, in his life and in his films. But I think you'd have to say that the bravado, the energy, the naturalness of the actors, the way they walk in and out of scenes, and, Pierre Roussian said, and I think this is true, that Walsh would have been a great director of Shakespeare, because you walk so naturally in and out of genre, in and out of mood and emotion and actual scenes. And I think it's the fluidity of Walsh that I see when I look. But no, I don't see a style. I couldn't really see a style with Stevens either. What I saw with Stevens was an interest of Americana. He was very interested in Americana. Walsh was very interested in romance. He was interested. People don't usually think of him that way. Walsh had also a sadness to him that a lot of people don't see. And if you look at the characters, there's more than a tinge of sadness to his great characters.
Sure.
You know, not always realistic, but even though I said he was realistic, but he went through stages, of course. He got more naturalistic as he went on into the 50s, but the early films, the earlier films at Warner Brothers were more doomed. You know, the characters were doomed, highly romanticized, some of them. To be so doomed can be romantic, you know, but especially when you see the cycle of films he did with his best ever buddy, Errol Flynn. They were, I mean, I think that Flynn was Walsh's persona. He was Walsh, especially in Gentleman Jim and They Died With Their Boots On. I think he really manifested Walsh's innards, even though Walsh wouldn't ever want to think that anything he thought or felt would be known to anyone. And when you talk about art, Walsh had a really singular moment in 1919 when he directed the film Evangeline, and it was panned by the critics, and it was based on Longfellow's poem, and he thought it was a work of art. And after that thing failed at the box office, he said, "I will never again make anything that is artful, that doesn't play exactly to Main Street. From now on, I'm going straight to Main Street, and that's where my audience is going to be." So art was not something Walsh ever would talk about. And he was like Ford in that way.
Yeah. He was exactly the opposite of Capra, who at some point decided he really needed to be more arty in order to start getting the awards that he wanted. And that was his at least his downfall for a while. But he got back to his populist roots.
He had too much going to ever be down there too long.
One of those things, one thing that all those guys have in common in the early to mid-70s, they all wrote autobiographies filled with lies. And
yes,
almost all of them did it.
Not true.
And Walsh's,
George did not.
No. Wellman wrote two of them.
Yeah.
And then the lies are rife in all of them. Highly entertaining stuff. I loved Walsh's book. But you can't believe a word of it, can you?
I basically couldn't get through it without having to put it down every so often or slam it down.
Well, it's one of those things you can only read when you don't know anything about the subject, which is the case when I read it, because I was in my 20s and I didn't know anything, so it was fun.
This became a real problem for me. One of my background areas is autobiography theory. So when I saw the autobiography, of course I know from reading autobiography theory and all of the French theorists, that when you actually put pen to paper, you're creating a new life. It may not have anything to do with your factual, chronological life, that you create yourself as you are writing. And on top of that, Walsh was a big believer in great stories. And I know one or two reviewers said, well, how come in her book she doesn't talk about the story where he actually meets Hitler? Well, I didn't talk about it because I didn't believe it. And I didn't have enough room to talk about things I didn't believe.
Sure.
I certainly didn't believe that at all. There was almost nothing that Walsh didn't embellish. So it became very difficult to find out what actually happened.
Didn't Flynn corroborate the John Barrymore's corpse story? Now, tell us that story, because
okay,
there might be people who don't know what that story is.
Oh, the story is that Flynn was, of course, just mad about John Barrymore. He was his hero. And when Barrymore died, Flynn was distraught. And one night, and according to who tells it, different people were at the house. At one point it was Ralph Bellamy, at one point it wasn't. He was part of the Irish Mafia, or the group of friends who were at Flynn's house. And Flynn said, and they're sitting at the dining room table, and Flynn says, "Just think, Barrymore will never again sit at that chair." And Walsh said, "Well, maybe," to himself, "maybe one more time." And this is the way Walsh's friend Bob Bookman told it to me, because Walsh told him about the story, which still doesn't mean it's true. But according to Walsh, as told to Bob Bookman, which is going to be in the second printing of my book, because we didn't get it in the first one, Walsh went down to the mortuary, which the name I forget at the moment, and downtown where Barrymore's body was lying in state. And he happened to know the man who was on duty that night because he was an old character actor from the silent Western days when Walsh was directing at with Griffith, or for Griffith. And he said, "Do you mind if I borrow that body?" And the guy said, "Sure." And he slipped him some money, took the body back. Sure. Took the body back to Flynn's house and propped it up on the dining room table. And Flynn walked in and almost had a heart attack. Okay. So Walsh said that he was never going to tell that story, but that Flynn talked about it in his autobiography, My Wicked, Wicked Ways, which led the way for Walsh then to be able to talk about it. But Flynn really outed him on the story before he wanted to talk about it to anyone. Do I believe the story? No. Does the family believe the story? No.
Yeah. I don't believe the story either, yet I love the story.
Yes.
So.
And that's what Walsh would love.
So I prefer to believe it, even though I don't believe it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He loved that story. But, I mean, in that autobiography, Each Man in His Time, there are many stories. And especially when he talks about his early life, it's very difficult. It took me many, many months to figure out where his family came from, because Walsh is a very common name in Ireland. And I did find out, though, that both families, mother's side, father's side, were Irish, because he did like to say that his mother was Spanish, which she wasn't. And he liked to say that his father came over with his three brothers, and they had just gotten his grandfather out of jail in Dublin, which is probably not true, because his father really was born and raised in England, even though they were from Ireland initially. And so there's more of an English connection than Walsh ever admitted to. And the story about him taking off on his uncle's ship, the Inniskellen, the schooner, I don't know about that. I don't know about that one. So it became difficult. And a lot of research went into finding the small amount that I was able to find on him. It got more factual for me as I was reading Miriam Cooper's book. Because even though she was probably lying many times, at least she was telling me exactly the things that happened and chronologically when they happened, which I could then do research on and figure it out. So her book, Dark Lady of the Silence, mm-hmm. was very helpful to me.
Well, it's interesting to contemplate the way he lied about his life. Because I think if I lied about my life, I might make myself look better in certain situations or, try to make myself come off better. But I don't know that I would invent another nationality for my mother or anything like that. I don't think it would even occur to me to do that.
Yeah.
And so it's funny. I mean, he really did embroider, and that's more than embroidering. He really did just invent things out of whole cloth.
But also that what I find in Walsh's stories is he's very self-effacing. And he does make fun of himself and doesn't always think highly of himself, even though you would think someone who climbs up those mountains, would revere his legendary status or something. But Walsh isn't doing that. He's doing it because he wants to have a good time. And that's really why he directed films. He wanted to travel. He wanted to have an adventure. And he got very close to the people on the set, the actors, not all. But especially the crew.
Well, what's always fun to me about those books, Raoul Walsh's, Wellman's, Capra's to a certain degree, is that even when they're writing about things that happen to themselves and say it's an anecdote with Carol Lombard or with Jean Arthur, the dialogue is always like movie dialogue. It never strikes you as being what people would say to each other.
It's also amazing to me that they can remember it, which means, of course, they're not. They're
yeah,
creating
course.
It.
Yeah.
You can't possibly do that.
Yeah, I think in the case of Wellman, I read his book, and I think I can always see a germ of truth in whatever story, and I can kind of extrapolate maybe what really happened and then how he wanted to build it up into a better story.
Sure.
Whereas in Walsh's, it seems to me that a lot of those stories he just came up with, just as, hey, I need a good story for this part of the book, and so he just came up with them.
I say this in my book, I don't think he saw a difference between his life and his movies.
Well, and also, and this is something that I've often thought about, because there weren't people like us, say before, I'd say Peter Bogdanovich and Kevin Brownlow in the 60s, the early 60s, were really the pioneers of asking people serious questions about what really happened. And before that, almost any article you read in a magazine or any autobiography by anybody, and I mean anybody in show business, it always seems kind of invented and presented in a certain way. And I was lucky enough to be at Howard Hawks one time when I was in college, and we were talking about, I was only able to talk to him for a few minutes, but he said, yeah, we never counted on people like you, you know, to that would really look into this stuff. And he was really talking about his films. I was asking him about a certain scene, and he was really talking about they never expected people to watch these things again and again and again and find all this stuff in them. They figured, if it gets through one screening, that's pretty much all you need.
Yeah, but I
think they also, they were used to telling a story in a certain way, and then for the rest of their lives, it never occurred to them that there would be people who would actually go into the records and go into the production reports and all that stuff.
And
why would they?
This is interesting because Walsh was around at the time. All of, you know, of course, they're all pretty much the same generation, and they were all around when all of these retrospectives began. I was asking Bob Bookman about this because he invited Walsh to Yale in 1972, and it was Walsh's first trip back to talk to students because he wasn't working, he had nothing to do, and he was only too happy to talk. And I think if you look at Walsh in the footage from The Men Who Made the Movies, he's said these stories, he's told these stories so many times that he could do them in his sleep. You know, he enjoyed the entertainment value of talking to people. I don't think he ever wanted to get that serious about it. But I thought it was an interesting phenomenon that in the early 70s, and I think for George Stevens it was a little earlier in the, maybe the late 60s, that they began talking to students at retrospectives, and this was a way for students to really find out who these men were, you know? And I thought that's a fascinating time. Because now it's, you know, we hold it so cheaply, we don't think twice about it.
But I tell you, Richard Schickel's Men Who Made the Movie series was incredibly important. And
yes.
I sometimes think it was the most important documentary series in my lifetime in terms of film. Because it really did introduce me to all of those guys whose work I knew to a certain extent. Because I was, 20, 21, something like that. And had grown up in South Carolina where you didn't see old films.
Right.
Except what happened to show up on TV, but there were no theaters.
Well, the French were doing this before that. I don't know if he was an interviewer or if he was, I think he was a journalist, LaBarthe. And he has footage of Walsh from 1965.
Wow.
And they were doing this in France. I mean, you know, there was Pierre Rissian. Going to the McMahon Cinema, which they didn't think was paying enough attention to American directors that they liked, who they liked. And he created what he called his four aces, the four famous guy, you know, the four famous faces that were looking down. What was it? Walsh, Preminger, Losey, and who was the fourth one? Walsh, Losey, Preminger. Well, anyway, there's a fourth one. And
it's got to be Cirque, right? Nick Ray?
It's
got to be one of those guys. Sam Fuller?
And I was just doing this. No, it wasn't. No.
Well, the French figured out that American filmmakers had been making something more interesting than we ever imagined. up to that point.
What I want to say about LaBarthe is is important in terms of what we were saying. And there's Walsh, and they're interviewing him at his ranch, which was still a ranch in Simi Valley in 65 before they had to, you know, the freeway encroached on him, and they still had horses and everything. And there is Walsh telling this guy, LaBarthe, that he was born in Texas or that he was born in Montana when he was clearly, obviously, everyone knew, raised upper middle class on Riverside, near Riverside Drive in New York City with a lot of money. And so there he's telling all these stories, and LaBarthe is standing there just eating it up, and he's believing him. So Walsh was telling these, you know, as Mark Twain used to say, I never knowed anyone who didn't lie one time or another, you know, a little here. They're called stretchers.
No, sure.
You know, and I think that's all. Walsh wasn't doing it in any sadistic or any way that would be sinister or advance his own legend. I think he was just having fun, you know.
Well, I think the concept of being brutally honest about your own life for strangers was foreign to a lot of these guys. Cause why would they? I mean, why would they talk about, tell them a good story instead? That makes more sense, and it makes people happy to hear a good story.
I don't know about the other directors that you've mentioned, about how they started out, but I know that Walsh, when he began, even in the 20s, he was already trying to manipulate the media. And in those days, of course, reporters who would be on the set for movie magazines like Photoplay or, you know, other, even local newspapers. And Walsh would do everything he could to make himself seem colorful. And these things all got reported. They all became, you know, reported, and they became fodder. And so Walsh, at least, and I bring this up in the book, that these directors were like a new creature. You know, they were like madmen. They could be madmen or they could be artists, but they were like, they weren't really understood this early on by the media, as far as I could see with Walsh. I don't know about, you know, people like Hawks or Wellman, or how they performed in the media, or whether or not they courted the media, but Walsh clearly did, because he thought this was a lot of fun.
So I think they all courted the media while pretending that they weren't. I think they all pretended like, I'm not interested in talking about myself because my life has just been too fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a great way of kind of deflecting and still inviting more interest.
Or looking like you're deflecting.
Yeah, yeah. And because they were, I mean, I don't know that you can be a director of that stature without being a little bit of an egomaniac, and certainly a guy who has to be in control and call the shots and all of that that comes with that. So, and especially in those days when you add the whole macho element to it, and they were all a little bit afraid of being thought of being prissy or artistic, or, and so they really wanted to make sure you knew how rugged they were. They were hunters and they were fighters, and all of Wellman's stories are about when he gets into fights with people.
Yeah.
Which, the more I look into it, the more it turns out to be true. You know, in those Western movies, when a fight starts in a bar and within 1 second everybody in the bar is fighting for no apparent reason, I think there were guys like that. And I think Wellman was one, and I've always wondered if Walsh was one. Because, well, tell me, tell me about how he lost his eye, and then, because this just reminded me of his great quote about why he didn't get a glass eye.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different versions of why he didn't, or what he told different people at different times. He lost his eye in 1928 when they were on location doing, in old Arizona, and he was playing the lead and directing, and it was the very first outdoor talkie. Okay, I'm sure it wasn't, but in a way it was for Fox. And Walsh was having trouble with one of the trucks, and he was in a Jeep. They were going back. I think they were going, they might have been driving back to Los Angeles. I'll have to go consult my book again. They were driving back, and his wife was actually in the truck with him, in the Jeep with him. No matter what he says, his wife was there, Lorraine, the second wife. And they were driving back. somewhere in Utah, and it was nighttime, and Walsh hit a rabbit. A rabbit just froze, and of course, Walsh hit the body. The body flew up into the windshield, went clear past the front seat and into the landed in the back seat. And just the driver's side, Walsh was driving, the glass splintered everywhere, and it lodged in his eye, and that's how. He didn't lose it immediately. There were surgeries. They immediately took him to Salt Lake City, because he was, as I said, in Utah. And then they flew him to New York. And eventually the doctors decided that they couldn't save the eye. And they just said, do you want a glass eye? And he said, no, in one of the versions. I don't want one because I'll have to put it in my pocket when I have, you know, when I'm involved in a fight with some hooligan and I'll lose it. You know, so that was one of the versions. But what I always love about the story of his losing his eye is that after a period of obviously depression and shock, he goes out on location and directs the big trail. When you talk about not only the process of grandeur, but the grandeur of the seven-state trek, and this man has monocular vision, and you think about the breadth of it all, of the locations, it's amazing to me.
Yeah, the Fox Grandeur process was a forerunner to CinemaScope. It was a 70 millimeter process or 65 millimeter process.
Yeah.
That was a widescreen, and it short-lived because sound was just coming in, and it was just too much for theaters to start dealing with a different way of projecting and all that stuff too.
Even though Fox promised that they would equip theaters, they didn't, and so I think it was only here and in New York. I know the film premiered at the Chinese theater.
But it's the big trail, for whatever its faults are, is magnificent to look at. And if you ever get a chance to see it, and I'm talking to my listeners, my happy listeners, if you ever get a chance to see a real theatrical print of this thing, it's amazing to see.
It's on DVD, but of course that doesn't do
it. Yeah, I mean, you can see at least the dimensions of it on DVD, but... And you can, you know, John Wayne, it was his first starring performance, and the failure of the film knocked him back into the ranks of B-Westerns for a long time.
And, of course, John Ford and Walsh good-naturedly argued, but not so good-naturedly underneath, about who found John Wayne, who actually gave him that stardom. And it was Walsh, but Ford had him in as extras, playing extra parts in films, but he wasn't really seen. And Walsh was the first one who put him in front of the camera. So Walsh wins that argument. But but it was, of course, Ford who had to rescue him in 1939 and give him back his career with Stagecoach. But
I tell you, he's already Wayne in the big trail, though. I mean, he is very... He was born with that persona. It's there.
And for my background in American literature, and especially, you know, mythic, myth that grew up in the mid-19th century, Wayne has to be a personification of what we call the American Adam. I mean, he was the innocent American who kind of sprang from the earth out of nowhere with no history, you know, just forward-looking. And Wayne was that character. He was the first, I think, visual personification I had ever seen because of his height,
mm-hmm.
because of his beauty. He was so beautiful at that stage. And he was Hawkeye. He was Leatherstocking. He was, you know, he was, in fact... Cooper's innocent, American innocent, and he was beautiful, and he really behaved like that in the film, you know.
And I still contend that he's the most criminally underrated actor in American history, because people always, for some reason, think that he was just this personality who happened to come across okay in movies, and I think he was terrific.
He was
just terrific.
He was an entire package. I mean, you had to see him in all of his glory, his the way he walked, the way he looked, and he always did have that kind of sadness underneath him, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see him in The Searchers, where he gets his most cynical and sinister, you know. But yeah, he he had it all. And Walsh saw that. And he said to him what he said to any actor, young actor, who he discovered and knew he was going to use. He said, keep your hair long, kid. Don't cut your hair. Because you'll be in front of the camera soon. He said the same thing, you know, to Rock Hudson, who he discovered, and could never get a good performance out of, whereas Douglas Sirk did,
sure.
And George Stevens. He said the same thing to Dobie Carey Jr., keep your hair long, kid. And he also, whenever he was going to use him in a part, and he also said that to L.Q. Jones.
Hmm.
Yeah, when he had him. Although you didn't have to have your hair long because it was for Battle Cry. So he probably didn't say that. He probably said it, but didn't plan on using the hair. But I was going to make a statement about George Stevens and why he and Walsh were so different. Because Stevens always did see his films as art. He thought films were art.
Sure.
Walsh would never admit to that. But Stevens always thought that they were art. That film was an art form that could easily share its life with being a commodity. You know, they make money, but they're also an art form. And Stevens also believed that you don't see a movie by yourself, because they didn't have the concept of people seeing a movie by themselves. He thought movies were created not only by him in the editing room, but by an audience mm-hmm. watching them together.
I agree.
It was a communal experience.
I still think that.
But the thing is, they didn't have any other experience. Mm. They didn't have DVDs. They didn't have people sitting in their living rooms watching things or on their computers or their phones.
I find, say, when I go to a festival like CineCon that shows early sound films, silent films, things that would just play adequately okay on TV, completely come to life with an audience.
Yeah.
And you suddenly think, this Boston Blackie is a great film. I mean,
yes.
It's amazing, the transformation. And I feel like I'm the, you know, crying in the wilderness, John the Baptist and crying in the wilderness, because nobody will listen anymore. I mean, it's, you know, oh, I've got Lawrence of Arabia on DVD. Why should I go? No, it's different. It's different.
Or Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah.
My favorite.
Yeah.
Of Lean's films.
And you know, and Stevens, this seems churlish to say that I regret how World War II affected him. I mean, obviously it did. But he made such beautifully artistic films before the war that were also wonderfully entertaining films. Mm-hmm. I was just watching Swing Time recently, and my gosh, what a great film that is. But also how beautifully shot.
Yes. I have a little story about that.
Yeah.
Just
go ahead.
One little quip, one little line. Hermes Pan said to who was the choreographer, said mm-hmm. to Stevens. Stevens had never directed a musical. And he said to him, just make sure you get their feet in. I always love that line. Make sure your camera gets their feet in. Just that's all you need to know.
That is a good lesson that people seem to forget.
But when you see the Bojangles sequence, you think Stevens was doing a little more than that.
Oh, sure.
You know? Yeah.
Oh, and the final number, Never Gonna Dance, is one of the most exquisitely photographed mm-hmm. sequences in any movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Forgetting how brilliant the dancing itself is, the movement of the camera and it's amazing. The art direction, everything comes together in this.
Stevens,
it's just magical.
He used to say he liked to get the actor's complacency riled, you know, like broken up, and he would place furniture, pieces of furniture on the set in their way. And they didn't know, and they'd come onto the set in the morning, and something would be set where it wasn't the day before, so that he would completely undo them and have them spontaneous.
Hmm.
You know, and he did that on purpose. Because, of course, Stevens was an actor's director, and they're really, even if you didn't like Stevens as an act, if you were an actor, actors were just indebted to him. And they always said it after they made a film with him. Richard Boehmer said at one point that he wrote a letter to Stevens and said, you know, I was in this film or that film. And the thing is, my career has gone kind of south I don't know if I should say that, but I don't have George any Stevens to help me anymore, to direct me anymore. Mm. And certainly he got the best performance out of Rock Hudson than anyone did in Giant, except for maybe Seconds. But, I mean, that was a very early performance, and it was a wonderful one. And Liz Taylor, too.
Yeah.
You know, she said she learned everything from Stevens.
Well, speaking of acting, and I don't know, I kind of dislike what-if scenarios, but I can't help but ask one. Do you think Walsh would have kept acting if the eye thing hadn't happened?
Probably.
Because he was already directing.
The fun of it. I mean, he was, don't forget, in front of the camera in Sadie Thompson. But not that much.
And Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation, and he broke his leg, or we're not sure if it was his knee or his leg or whatever, his shin, in the same place that, or very near to the place that John Wilkes Booth broke his when he jumped on stage after assassinating Lincoln. Would he? I don't think that much. He probably would have done it here and there. But when you think about it, even before the eye accident, he wasn't on stage all that. He wasn't in front of the camera that much.
No, he was in the Villa film, too, wasn't he, as young Pancho Villa?
That's a whole other wonderful story. Yeah, played Villa.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because that film is gone, right? There's nothing left of it.
There's a great documentary I should get to you. A guy did, a Mexican film director, documentarian, when he went searching for the footage.
Mm.
Not because he liked Walsh, but because he was trying to find Villa. But
he was actually in Mexico with Villa.
Yes, he was. If you read Kevin Brownlow's book, that tells you a lot of good information about that Griffith wasn't the first person, the first company to go down there, that Villa wanted to be in the movies. He wanted to get the money, and he wanted to have his cause supported financially. And so when Griffith did decide to go down there, according to Walsh, he said, "Hey, you speak Spanish, don't you, kid?" And he said, "Sure," because, of course, he had been, you know, running around in Cuba, maybe. And he actually had to convince Villa, according to Walsh, and there are, again, many versions of this story, and he had to convince Villa, which I don't think was really true because Villa was so gung-ho about doing this, but he had to tell Villa what the movie was going to be about, and he made it up on the spot, telling him about, you know, Villa, this romantic young boy named Pancho Villa. His mother is taken hostage and his sister is raped, you know, and he has to seek revenge and this, that, and the other. But the funniest part about the story of his being actually in Juarez to make the film is that he did convince Villa to have the executions that he was going to carry out in the daytime so that he could film them, so that he would move hangings and all kinds of murder by death for
firing
the camera.
Firing squads, too, yes.
Our firing squads, yeah. Yeah, and he would do that. So I think they paid him $500. That's one of the versions. There's so many versions. That's another one of those myths that you love the myth, but you don't really ever know and don't really want to ever know what really happened. It's fine just to have the various versions. And as I tried to do in the book, I tried to respect Walsh, because the most important thing to Walsh was that the myth and the reality kind of become vague.
Mm-hmm.
The line between them become vague, and I felt that was really important to him, and I'm gonna keep that. You know, if you can, you want to separate and you want to find out what really happened, and some of it's easy to do because you have, you know, Warner Brothers memos, but for the most part we love the stories. And George Stevens didn't tell stories. One story about George Stevens is that he did, when at a very early age, when he became a cameraman, and he did work with Native Americans, the myth grew up that he was Native American, part Native American, which was not true. But he kept his mouth shut so that he wouldn't destroy the myth, because he liked it. He liked that tale, but he wasn't. He was Irish. So.
Well, we should wrap up soon, but before we do, I want to ask you a little bit about Cirque, and I can't think of a more of a 180 degree turn from Walsh than Douglas Cirque. But how did you become interested in doing this?
When I learned about Cirque's life and put it together with how important melodrama is in American cinema, and then when I learned that Cirque was directing melodramas in Germany before he even got here, I thought, this is a fascinating character. And I always like to work on directors who don't have a biography. You know, I'd rather go there first myself. And Cirque does not have a biography. And I found things I didn't even expect, and that is that Cirque brought a certain tragedy to all of his films, which are pessimistic, to say the least. Cirque had a very tragic life in Germany. He was a very well-respected director of theater, and when the Nazis took more and more power, he had to get out of the theater, because that's the first place they went, was theater, to try to control it. So he got into film, and he was making films at UFA, which was the national, you know, film office, production company. And then Goebbels became very active in UFA. And what happened was Cirque had married a woman, and they had a son, and they divorced. And she was an actress, and she raised the son away from Cirque to become an actor. And Cirque remarried, and he was not Jewish, but he married a Jewish woman named Hilde. And when the first wife found out about this, she joined the Nazi party. And she would not let him ever see his son. And the only way he could see his son was to go to the movies.
Hmm.
And then when his son was 19, he enlisted, or somehow got enlisted in the SS, and was killed at the front.
Wow.
So this was a very tragic story for Cirque. He lost his son without ever having been able to see him for years. So he and Hilde had to hightail it out of Germany, because Goebbels was strong-arming him and taking. He took away his passport at a certain point. And Hilde left first. They let her leave. I don't know why, but they let her leave. And then Cirque left. He joined her in Italy. And they very quietly got out of Italy, went to Paris for a while, went to Switzerland, went to Zurich, and then came to the U.S. And when he got here, he was not your typical emigre. He was not Jewish. He was not running away from Hitler the way Billy Wilder, or not Wilder, but a lot of people were.
Sure.
And he got here and couldn't find a job. And had a chicken farm, alfalfa farm, out in Covina. And those actually were the happiest days of his life. Cirque never really fit in Hollywood. He was here, made some wonderful films, and then became very, very desired at Universal. His last film there was Imitation of Life, but even before that was released, he had already planned to leave. He didn't fit in. He didn't like it here. He never really had that many friends here. But the film that I think is Cirque's most beautiful and most personal is A Time to Love and A Time to Die,
mm-hmm.
which is a story by Eric Maria Remarque, who is in the film. Cirque wanted him in the film. They actually shot it on location in Germany, in Berlin. And I was lucky enough, fortunate enough, to talk to John Gabin about that film, because it is really the story of a young German soldier, and it is autobiographical in that sense, that he's reliving what his son, or reimagining what his son must have gone through. And I won't tell you the tragic ending of the film, but you can probably guess. Okay.
Yes, Cirque is another one of those people who
is revered by the French.
Revered by the French.
Brought to light by the French.
Yeah.
And now revered so much, and never was in his own lifetime.
Yeah.
Although he began to see it in the late 60s and early 70s. Catherine Bigelow, the director, was very enamored of Cirque and did a very long interview with him, which I was able to find for Interview Magazine, with Andy Warhol's Interview Magazine.
Yeah.
But Cirque has a great following.
Yeah, he so easily misunderstood because the melodrama is so almost stylized. He really pushes things to a limit. And
almost surreal.
Yeah, it's almost surreal. He doesn't, it's not naturalistic filmmaking in any way. And I think some people are put off by it or misunderstand it because of that. But I think I think from the very beginning, I mean, Imitation of Life is one of the most moving films, and I'm just always awash in tears. With Susan Conner
following the hearse
and everything.
Really?
Oh man!
Yeah. I know everyone loves that film. And the race issue certainly it's important. I'm really a sucker for All That Heaven Allows.
Oh, me too. Oh yeah.
You know,
and they're also beautiful. I mean, so beautifully photographed. And
the deer at the end. I mean, talk about stylized, and about, you know, Shane. I mean, that's nothing compared to that deer walking into that huge picture window at the end.
Sure.
You know, of All That Heaven Allows. And, you know, Cirque, it's tough for me because having been out of the intellectual... the rigorous intellectualism that you have to know with Cirque, because of his background, his education, his interest, Schopenhauer, I mean, philosophers and, you know, psychoanalysis. He loves psychoanalysis. And you just don't have to do that when you're working on George and Raoul. With Raoul, you're like on the horse and you got to get off and you've got to go back.
Sure.
And you've really got to read. And that's what I'm doing now, because Cirque was a dedicated Schopenhauer pessimist.
No. Well, when the book is out, we will talk again. Let's do that. And this has been a real great pleasure for me. I really appreciate your doing this.
Great.
So thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed my interview with Marilyn Moss. I could talk about guys like Raoul Walsh and George Stevens all day long, and luckily have another interview with her in which we do just that. So it'll be coming up in the weeks ahead. Who knows exactly when. Some week when I suddenly realize I haven't interviewed anybody for that week and I go into a panic mode, and then I'll think, wait a minute, I have another interview with Marilyn Moss. So it'll go right back in. I want to thank all the people who helped put this podcast together. James Hutchins, who designed my website, thecommentarytrack.com. I hope you'll go there often, daily, maybe several times daily. Buy books and videos and go to the links for all my guests where I have all their books and videos and Amazon links to buy them. If you go to Amazon through my website, I get a little bit of a kickback, and Lord knows, I'm bleeding out enough money putting this podcast on, and it would be wonderful to have some seep back in a little bit. A little bit of backwash is always welcome in these cases. So I urge you, if you feel like buying anything from Amazon, and everybody buys something from Amazon almost every day, right? I urge you to go through my website, thecommentarytrack.com. Remember, it's thecommentarytrack.com. And if you click through Amazon, through my website, then all will be well, and a little bit of money will come dribbling in. I will be happy as the proverbial clam in high tide, and we'll get along just fine. There's going to be other stuff coming up on the website in the near future. Have at least one book almost ready to go, and it will be offered first as a hardcover book, then as an ebook, then as a print-on-demand, cheaper version of said hardcover book. I'm also planning to do some actual commentary tracks of movies, which is what this project started out being a couple of years ago, and then turned into a podcast. And in the final analysis, I'm glad that it did, because I'm having a great time. Thanks also to my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, who acts as my announcer at the beginning, since I couldn't afford the great word car.
I'm glad that Claire stepped up to the plate. And also thanks to Gary Rand and Rob Clearfield for writing my theme music. I love the theme music, and several people have mentioned to me how much they like it, and often the word classy is involved. I never meant for this thing to be a classy podcast, but that music certainly helps it become so. And then, of course, I start talking, and it becomes less so, but then the music comes back, and with any luck, it leaves you with a good taste in your mouth. So thanks very much for joining me. Next week, we'll have another fine interview with John Bengtson. If you know his wonderful books on locations of on the films of Chaplin, Keaton, and Lloyd, you know that this guy is a miracle worker when it comes to finding these things. He has an eye that I can't even dream of having. They're wonderful things, and we had a great interview when I was at his house near San Francisco a little while back, and I hope you will enjoy that. That will be coming up next week. So thanks again. Listen every week. Please go to iTunes and leave a rave review. If you feel like giving a bad review, just suppress that thought and go away. I appreciate it. It'll help get other people to listen, and the more ears, the better. So thanks a lot. And don't worry, we'll fix it in post.